Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's June 18, 37 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and Erica not picking up this morning. So I'll tell you, we've got sunshine today with a high of 63, an overnight low of 40. Sunny and 67, sunshine and 72 on Saturday, into the upper 70s by Saturday, and we're going to be back into the 80s by Monday. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'm scheduled to talk with Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde with an update from yesterday's council meeting. Later on, Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter talking to us about policing policies and issues related to national issues of police brutality and the protests happening locally. And finally, the general manager of Woodward Park City, Shadar Edelman, has details of the reopening of Woodward Park City. Stay tuned. And it looks like I've got Erica now on the phone. Good morning to you, Erica.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much. We are going to see a really nice day in the forecast, mostly clear skies for much of the day. Now, right around 2 to 3 p.m., we're going to see a few extra clouds developing. There's a little bit of a lobe that's going to just make the dynamics pop a little bit more. So I want to go ahead and just give you guys a heads up now. For the most part, a great day. That fog is mixing out. Any patchy fog that remains is mixing out because that area of high pressure is doing a really great job right now. Otherwise, by later tonight, we're going to see conditions improve and then mostly sunny skies for your Friday and for Saturday. Now, we start to climb back up into the upper 60s by Friday. Initially, I had us at a low 70, upper 60 yesterday, 69, 70. Today, I'm going to go with a 68-degree day for your Friday. On Saturday, low 70s, and it looks like we're going to see mostly sunny skies. Now, don't forget the summer solstice is at 3:43 p.m., and on Sunday, we're going to see a high of 78 degrees. I bumped us down from that 80 initially. A mix of sun and clouds, more sunshine there. Now, by next Monday, the ridge of high pressure is going to be nice and strong, so we're going to see temperatures climb into the 80s. Overnight lows are going to start to build nicely. Upper 40s Saturday into Sunday. Sunday into Monday, we're going to see low 50s. And then by Monday into Tuesday, we're going to see overnight lows in the mid-50s with more sunshine to kick off the following work week as that area of high pressure really does hold nicely. And that's going to be the trend through the middle of the week. I have building clouds, your extended forecast, late Wednesday into Thursday and Friday. But for right now, not seeing much in precip. Otherwise, for tonight, just be mindful of the fact that you'll see a few extra clouds develop later in the day.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on Cool Science Radio, right after the local news hour, today's guests are science journalist Deborah McKenzie. She's written the first book to be published on COVID-19, titled COVID, the Pandemic That Never Should Have Happened and How to Stop the Next One. She discusses the previous viruses that it should have prepared us and the shocking public health failures that led to this disaster, as well as the failure to contain the outbreak. Then Brian Dumain, an award-winning journalist and contributing editor at Fortune magazine, talks about his new book, Bezonomics, how Amazon is changing our lives and what the world's best companies are learning from it. It offers a fascinating look at Jeff Bezos and the company that he built, which is disrupting the business world, the physical retail landscape, and nearly all of consumer behavior. News Time now, 8:10. Well, Summit County officials hosted a webinar Tuesday night to discuss the future of trail access in the Snidaville Basin. Access to Summit County's extensive trail system has been a touchy subject for many locals, with increased use causing congestion and other issues on the trails and trailheads. KPCW's Sean Higgins sat in on the meeting, and he has this report.
The virtual meeting lasted 2 hours and was open to the public, with nearly 80 members of the community joining the Zoom call. All major stakeholders were present, with members of the County Council, Basin Recreation, Sheriff's Office, Mountain Trails Foundation, Park City, and Animal Control all in attendance. Officials say the explosion in popularity of trails in and around Park City in recent years has caused a number of problems for residents, like crowded trailheads, users not following rules for dogs on the trail, trespassing, and increased noise and parking problems in residential areas. Summit County Attorney Margaret Olson characterized many of the recent complaints from residents living near the trail system as increasingly frantic. She says public input is essential if a remedy to these problems is to be found.
And we're asking for the public's input. What is going to work? What is going to be an effective solution, because it's going to have to be a package of solutions.
With roughly 170 miles of multi-use trails, the system in the Snyderville Basin is one of the most extensive in the country and has been gradually expanded and integrated into local neighborhoods through a series of bond measures that started in the mid-90s, with the most recent in 2014. Many of the trails are on public land, but much of the system does wind through private property with access granted through easements with the affected property owners. Officials ran through several possible solutions to the current problems, like transit shuttles, paid parking at trailheads, limiting certain trails to only one user type, like hikers or bikers, directional use trails, and trail ambassadors to help with trail education and outreach in the community. Matt Wagoner is the Trails and Open Space Manager for Basin Recreation and says that a combination of these potential fixes are likely the best path forward.
The point is that none of them alone is really a silver bullet. The idea is that we might implement a handful of these solutions and then collectively see some results from their implementation. It's a selection of things that are kind of implementable in a shorter term.
Wagoner adds that utilizing technology like cameras to help trail users and officials determine the most heavily trafficked trails and times of day are also an option. The last hour and a half of the meeting was dedicated to public comment, and many questions centered around vehicle traffic and the implementation of a paid parking program at trailheads. Commenters were worried over whether locals would be subject to the same fees as out-of-town visitors and if paid parking at trailheads would force more parking into residential areas. Community member Kathy Mears was part of the two most recent bond processes and says that locals who are already paying for trail upkeep through their taxes should not have to pay any extra fees to utilize their local trails.
I served on BOSAC for 5 years, and I was on committees for the last two open space bonds to help get those passed. I realize there are solutions that have to come. I feel as a resident who's paying for those bonds still in my taxes, it would be offensive to me if you asked me to pay for parking at the trailheads that I'm already paying for.
Basin Recreation District Director Brian Hanton says that a paid parking program is not at the top of their list of solutions right now, but understood that it would create unique challenges that would have to be addressed.
From a Basin Rec standpoint, we recognize that there would be some challenges if we did have paid parking in areas. And knowing that this is a solution that it would be kind of more down the road, if we can't implement some of the other things first, then this would be something that we could look to implement. But we think there are other options that we could try first before taking that step to paid parking. But we're obviously continuing to look at everything that we can.
Summit County Council hopes to revisit trail access issues in July. If you missed Tuesday's webinar, public comment on these issues is still open through the Summit County website and their social media channels, and you can also find a link on our website, kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
KPCW News time now, 8:15. 8:15 now on your Community Connection. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Summit County Council had a long, tough discussion about how the COVID crisis may impact the county's budget. On the phone with an update on that, as well as some other items, is the chair of the County Council, Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first, let's just real quick, the Tuesday's trail discussion. Was that something that you tuned into?
I unfortunately did not. I had a conflict and was not able to tune into that.
Sure. So it says, though, that we're reporting that the council hopes to revisit trail access issues in July. Any idea what that discussion is going to center on?
Well, it's a broad discussion about the full range of problems that we're confronting right now. And that is certainly, you know, perhaps, if not in reality worse, at least it appears worse as a result of the COVID situation, in which large numbers of people from the Valley are viewing us as their outdoor recreation site, period.
All right. Well, let's talk about yesterday's discussion. When I say long discussion, we're talking like two hours over the published agenda.
It was only a 7-hour Zoom call. I mean, geez. Yeah.
Later this month, the county manager will meet with the department heads, give them some direction on budget preparations for next year. Are we in a worst-case scenario at this point?
Well, I think to some degree we don't know what the worst case is, right? We just simply don't have enough data at this point. What we were talking about yesterday was, look, okay, we finally got a little glimpse of what the actual data is, and the actual data for for the month of the last couple of weeks of March and early April was very bad. Depending on whether you were looking at lodging tax or restaurant tax, we were off in the order of 40 to 50%. We don't believe that that's the way we're going to be for the balance of the summer. But at this point, we don't know. And that remains to me to be seen. So what we were doing really was sort of preparing everybody, bracing everybody for the full range of discussions that we might have later in the year.
All right. So we're reporting those restaurant tax and TRT revenues down March through May. Is that the correct time frame there?
I believe that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we're hearing from Park City Main Street merchants in the last couple of weekends that they've been at 90% of last year. So is it really as bad as we might think?
Well, I mean, first of all, we're ecstatic especially that Sunday project was successful. That's great. We hope they can build on that. But again, that's a brief window of hope. We can pair that against a very brief glimpse of absolute despair. So the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle.
So will we have to make any other further budget changes before approving the 2021 budget in December?
Not to the current budget. Obviously, that's our fixation. What will the next budget year look like? But we believe the current budget is set. So yes, nothing. No immediate changes now.
Council members seem to say that we should be keep being careful, though, following an austerity model. Do you agree with that?
That we should be careful.
Planning ahead, for next year.
Yes, absolutely. We're looking at delaying most significant capital projects to the extent that they can be. We've had a hiring freeze since, a little bit after, after the first signs of COVID hit. And we've also got wages frozen and are looking judiciously at all departments and all budgets.
How much do you think we're going to need to dip into our fund balances? Budget manager Matt Levitt mentioned a rule of thumb that if you're not getting any other revenues, your fund balances should be able to support you for 2 months. And he says that you do have that much.
Right. Yeah. And I think the technical answer we came to last night after applying all the available science was just enough and not too much. We don't have hard answers. We know we have those reserves and there are other reserves out there as well. But for right now, we just know that we need to be extremely cautious.
All right. Did Matt give us a forecast for this summer and fall?
Not in any rigorous sense.
All right. And what about the need to dip into the tax stability fund, which I believe actually requires a public vote, right?
That's correct. Yeah. It is not our intention at this point to dip into the tax stability fund. The purpose of the fund is a little bit multifaceted, but it is, among other things, designed to help out during disasters. Or alternatively, you build the fund up and you you use the interest from that fund to augment your spending on an annual basis. So it's out there. Our intention is not to dip into it. We certainly will if we have to.
A second major topic was how should the county spend money that it's getting from the federal's CARE Act, which is dispersed from the state. At most, the county could get just under $6 million. You've received your first allocation of close to $2 million, and the first priority that it must be spent for COVID-related experiences, expenses, so that you really can't use it for items that you had previously budgeted.
Right, and certainly the finding a place to spend that $6 million is not a problem. We've got plenty of COVID-related expenses and that we've already spent money on, and plenty more that this funding allows us to spend money on. They range from everything from public education to quarantine facilities to tracking patients, tracking contacts from virus-related people who are infected and had contact with other individuals, which we're now tasked with tracking. So all those expenses are out there. Some of those monies we've already spent yet. Others were anticipating gearing up for over the summer. These are all monies that have to be spent before, I believe it's 1st of November.
All right. You suggested using some money for communications because you feel like the messaging is fractured. What would you like to see communicated better?
Well, we are not going to recover in any meaningful way in the near term if we do not change our behavior. And by changing our behavior, that principally involves social distancing and wearing masks. And unfortunately, there is not a uniform ethos, if you will, about wearing masks with the public throughout the country, let alone throughout the state. And I think that is that's the big message that we need to get out. The trouble that we're having with that is that our message is fractured in that it is coming from a bunch of different organizations. We have the Restaurant Association, we have the Lodging Association, we have the Chamber, we have, of course, Park City Municipal, we have the Health Department. All of those people are delivering messages about how to stay safe and stay well. We need to collect all those efforts and formalize them in a uniform message so that the public understands when they come to visit our properties, what it is that we expect of them. And at least in the near term, wearing masks is an absolute essential item.
Do you think another item that you mentioned was quarantine facilities for people who are well enough to be released from the hospital but still too sick to go home to their families? What does this look like?
Right. Well, hopefully we believe it to be a small effort, but nonetheless an extremely important one. And this was triggered by an anecdote, essentially, of a person who was hospitalized with COVID, was on oxygen, managed to recover to the point where they were able to go home, but going home meant going home to a small apartment that, had very high living density with her surrounding family members. And that is not a practical model. We need some place for those individuals to be able to quarantine, and especially with our most vulnerable population, we can't expect them to quarantine on their own. It's all they can do to maintain their existing living situation, let alone rent properties that they can quarantine in. So for those people who are economically less facile than the rest of us, we need to provide them with facilities.
There was also a presentation from the sheriff and his lieutenant. What were your impressions from that?
Well, I think that Sheriff Martinez, at the onset of his career when he became elected sheriff, had a more progressive model of policing in his mind, and he has been implementing that. And I think he described it in brief summary as being, let's stay off the highways, let's stay off the freeways, let's get down into the neighborhoods, let's interact with the public, let's say hello to those people who are selling lemonade and those kids that are selling lemonade stands, have lemonade stands, and let's interact with them and make sure that we're building relationships with our community that will serve us going forward. So I believe that model has been in place for some time. Of course, it is now one of the hottest topics in the nation. And so we'll be revisiting that, I'm sure. But what we were looking for from Justin and Andrew last night was simply a beginning of a discussion, a beginning of airing out about what our policies are and how we hope to interact with the public.
Finally, the county's 2020 tax sale is set for June 25th. Three owners approached the county council to accept payment plans or deferrals on what they owe in taxes. Most interesting case was from a Colville resident asking for a deferral. He had a payment plan set up in 2018, then he was laid off last year. He said he generates income from being a stage and lighting manager, an event organizer, an artist, designing composting toilets for large events. And basically, he said COVID has wiped out all of his income for those jobs. And if that wasn't enough, he apparently caught the virus in March, has been quarantined and still testing positive. Sounds like this guy needs a break. Did the council give it to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that, paying your taxes, obviously, is an obligation that not only do we take seriously, but that's one of our principal jobs, is to collect taxes. And so we do, we do not in any way encourage people to be slack on that. However, here's a situation where we've got a local resident who is employed in what are our most vulnerable industries right now. And then has a case of the virus that is severe. It's not, he didn't get over it in 3 or 4 weeks. He's apparently in the neighborhood of 8 weeks, and still has the virus. So he can't work even if he could find a job. So that is exactly the sort of person who, we feel comfortable giving some slack to in terms of delaying the payment of his taxes. Ultimately, of course, this will come down to, if he's not able to pay in the future, there will be a tax sale of his property. But certainly for the next year, we don't see any reason to force that issue.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Doug?
I think that's it. Leslie, thank you.
Thank you. That's Summit County Council Member Chairman Doug Clyde. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. 8:31, good morning. With the death of George Floyd last month and more recently the fatal shooting of Rayshard Brooks, the national conversation is focused on policing policies and racial bias. On the phone to discuss what we're doing here in the Park City Police Department, I have Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. First, can you talk a little bit about how your officers are responding to what's happening across the country?
Well, yeah, it's difficult for all law enforcement officers throughout the country. Obviously, I also sit as the fourth vice president for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. So I have daily conversations with chiefs throughout the country, actually throughout the world. And we've talked about the frustrations that law enforcement is feeling, and obviously trying to regain those relationships of trust with our community. And it's very unfortunate that the George Floyd incident, that, as I said many, many times, all officers that I've spoken to, commanders, chiefs, all are very upset with what happened in that situation, and nobody condones that type of behavior. Unfortunately, I think it's really tainted and tarnished all of our badges in a sense that we've had good relationships in many of our communities throughout the country, and now I think there's a perception that law enforcement is okay with this, and it absolutely is not. And I think that's frustrating for officers.
Yeah. Recently, you discussed with the Park City Council, some 8 recommendations for policing improvement have been discussed nationally. You had mentioned to the council that Park City Police follows 6 of those. 2 of those you cannot. So what is it that you cannot follow, and why not?
So if you would like to go through those, they're actually required de-escalation of force, which we've always trained our people. In fact, we participate in what's called the IACP One Mind campaign. Our officers have all completed mental health first aid training, additionally crisis intervention training, which focuses on de-escalation during critical situations. We also participate in de-escalation training through the Utah Attorney General's office, which is scenario-based situations that change as it actually responds to how the officer reacts to the scenario that's being played out on a 360-degree screen. If the officers are not reacting appropriately, it continues to escalate, which gives us the ability to look at what's being done, what's not. One of these are requiring a warning prior to shooting, and obviously, I've heard 2 iterations of this. One was require warnings prior to shooting, and also if officers have the ability to shoot at a moving vehicle. And those are 2 issues that, when practical, we can give a prior warning. And as you watched a lot of the things as they unfolded in Atlanta, that's exactly what the officers were doing there as well. We're telling him to drop the taser over and over and going through that. And I think our officers are trained to do that as well. Unfortunately, in some scenarios, an officer does not have time to provide a warning. So I think it's important that community members and those that are dealing with these issues recognize that. Additionally, the issue of shooting at moving vehicles. We're in a time that many people have forgotten this, but there have been several concerns with prohibiting police officers from ever using this tactic. We've seen an increase over the past few years and worldwide of terrorists using vehicles to ram large crowds. And people have been able, officers have been able to decrease the loss of life through shooting at moving vehicles when they're running over citizens. This, of course, is not a common tactic to discharge a firearm at a moving vehicle, but would be detrimental if this was completely removed. There's been multiple cases throughout the country, New York included, during the marathon, where that individual was stopped by, they shot at a moving vehicle and stopped his actions from killing more people. Additionally, Utah's had 2 officers over the past 3 years who've been struck and killed by moving vehicles. One of the most recent was the West Valley officer, Cody Brotherson, that was intentionally struck and killed during a police pursuit of a stolen car where he was trying to pull spikes and the subjects ran him over intentionally. So, Leslie, I think this is one that obviously we struggle with, and there's much more to it to protect our communities rather than just removing that.
Are officers then trained to shoot to kill? I mean, why not aim for a leg or an arm or something?
So this is another issue. A lot of times people have a perception that in high stress, first off, that you can actually hit an appendage like an arm or a leg. And depending on how the person's moving, it may or may not be effective. And there's multiple case studies through Force Science, through Dr. Lewinsky, that prove that an assailant can continue to return fire even after being hit with a bullet upwards of 30 times. So an officer or others can be injured if there's, as we were saying, you shoot a leg or an arm, they can continue to return fire on the officer. So essentially, if deadly force is warranted, that's how the officers are trained, because the assailant typically will continue to return fire, and that could harm citizens. That could also kill more officers.
Yeah, and certainly assuming, though, that the person has a firearm. In many cases, they don't.
Well, and that's always the question, and that's the reason we have the processes set up that we do. An officer does the best they can do based on what those circumstances are, and we can't always control those circumstances. That's the reason we continue to stress, when an officer gives a lawful order, that it's important those are complied with, because we can't see, we don't have a controlled environment that a lot of people think we do.
Yeah. And something else that was been brought up in terms of is it the police who should respond to mental health calls, or should we consider some other social systems of managing nonviolent issues?
So first off, in as I've stated before, on many of these situations, our officers are trained, as I said, on CIT, critical incident training, meaning it's de-escalation training to recognize individuals that are struggling from drug-induced psychosis to having a mental break of some sort. And unfortunately, when individuals are in this situation, a therapist cannot accurately, and many times, even now, we obviously have those relationships with county and state resources for treatment. However, they are not going to treat those individuals while they are impaired. And many times these individuals are impaired. So the thought of sending a therapist out in the field is not even realistic. We oftentimes have tried, at least in other agencies I've worked at, to try to bring therapists into the field. And typically that's not even practical based on resources that they have. So we have tried to train all of our officers, are in the process, that, like I stated, giving them mental health first aid and CIT training so that they can evaluate those. Once the individual is no longer a threat to themselves or others, then we'll transport that person to the hospital facility for evaluation.
Yeah. You've also talked about your expectation that your patrol officers know their neighborhoods. Is that how they're assigned to, that they cover the same neighborhoods over and over? Or
they have sector responsibility, meaning they have accountability to the community, accountability to their sectors. We like to keep them in the sectors because they start community policing programs within those sectors. And they have a better understanding and a pulse of what's going on. Obviously, for us, that's very important because they learn who those individuals are working in that area. It gets them out of their car, gets them to where they have created relationships of trust, especially with the young people in the neighborhoods. I think it's important that they know the officers as friends. And I think that happens in our, all of us have had experiences where we have very positive relationships with the people in the community.
Let's talk a little bit about just the racial makeup of our police force here. Does it reflect the population that you're serving?
Yeah, we constantly are working on that. We try very hard to recruit and hire officers from different ethnic backgrounds. Currently, our makeup is 84% Caucasian, 12% Hispanic, 6% Pacific Islander and Asian. Additionally, we have six of our sworn officers out of 33 are Spanish speakers. Our total staff, or non-sworn, are 7 Spanish speakers, and which is about 18% of our workforce are Spanish speakers. Many of those are actually Caucasian, which I think is interesting. A couple of our Hispanic officers actually, or Latino officers, speak Spanish.
Huh. So are there Spanish language requirements for new hires?
So we give preference to Spanish-speaking officers or anyone that's bilingual, to include those that can sign. We always are trying to find individuals with different skill sets to kind of offset what we don't have. That's always been a priority for us, and we try to encourage individuals. Many times we go to the satellite academies, and that essentially is self-sponsored officers that are going through the academy with the intent of being a police officer. We try to recruit in those environments. Park City's been very fortunate in the sense that we have not had to sponsor officers through the academy, meaning at our own cost, that we've been able to be very selective in what we're hiring to fit the needs of our community. Which most agencies don't have. We're over almost 700 officers down in the state of Utah, and Park City typically is less than 3% underfilled. So we do a lot to try to close that gap. Leslie, additionally, our command staff is 60% Caucasian, and 20% has a 20% makeup of Hispanic and Pacific Islander.
All right. Tell me again, so how many officers do you have full-time?
So we have 33 officers. We have about, with our reserves, another 12. And then we actually contract with almost 120 officers throughout the state for our special event staffing. We've tried to be very careful to keep costs down for our community, our taxpayers, and so we have contracted for special events, so we're not paying entire benefit packages to those officers. Unfortunately, those times are changing where officers and agencies are understaffed, and so we're having a hard time filling some of those shifts.
All right, so those percentages you gave to me reflect the 45, the officers and the reserves?
So I have it broke down in two different categories, and I can give you those by category. So by sworn officers full-time, 84% of our officers are white, 12 are Hispanic, 6 are Pacific Islander, 12% are female, 88% are male. On our reserves, 92% are white, 8% are Hispanic, 92% are male, 8% are female. And then non-sworn staff is 88% are Caucasian, 25% are male, and 75% are female. So we have a much higher percentage on our support staff that are female on the non-sworn positions. And that's based really on who's applying for the position. So we always are trying to encourage. We actually changed part of our physical fitness standard to broaden we used to use the bench press, and we realized that was creating issues on the physical fitness requirement. So we've gone to more of a non-gender biased approach to that.
Okay. Hey, I wanted to ask you finally just about your health. As we've reported, you had tested positive for the COVID virus. You came out okay, it sounds like. You're doing fine?
Absolutely. So the other day I had the opportunity to do the antibody test. 40 is the high, the highest you can get. I'm 39, so I should be pretty bulletproof. I'm feeling well now. It was a long road. I will tell you that it was a painful process, and it was very real. It was a struggle, but doing much better now. Thank you.
Painful meaning just with
a lot of joint pain. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fatigue, a lot of muscle cramping, fever, chills, that type of thing, and it lasted about 9 days, and I wasn't feeling well for close to 20 days.
Wow. Well, good. We're glad you made it to the other side here.
Thank you. I'm too.
Anything else you wanted to mention, Wade?
Yeah, I just really appreciate the community. Unfortunately, a lot of times we see in the media that it paints these pictures that we don't have these positive relationships with the communities that we serve. And I really don't think that's the case. We have seen such an outpouring from our community support. We've had many of the businesses unsolicited cater lunch. We've had many of our community members bring food over. They've been very supportive. When I was working actually down in Salt Lake during the riots, we had a very similar situation while we were trying to enforce the curfew. Many of the neighbors that brought their children out spoke to us, and they were, you know, mixed race. They told us this was not indicative of the feelings of them or really of the community. And I think there was this perception that was the case, and I really don't believe that that's what's happening in our country.
All right. Wade Carpenter, appreciate your insight. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Well, you'll hear more about this at the top of the hour from National Public Radio, but just this breaking news here. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that DACA recipients can continue to live and work in the United States without the daily fear of deportation. The Supreme Court rejecting President Donald Trump's efforts to end legal protections for the 650,000 young immigrants, a stunning rebuke to the president in the midst of his reelection campaign. The vote was 5-4, with Chief Justice John Roberts casting the decisive fifth vote that sought to bridge the liberal and conservative wings of the court. Roberts and the court's four liberal justices said the Department of Homeland Security's decision to rescind DACA was arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedure Act. Began in 2012, the DACA program gave temporary protection from deportation to qualified individuals brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Under the program, the Dreamers were allowed to work legally and apply for college loans if they met certain requirements and passed a background check. President Trump sought to end the program shortly after he took office, maintaining that it was illegal and unconstitutional from the start. Again, stay tuned to hear more on the story from NPR there at the top of the hour. Well, like the rest of the resorts across the country, Woodward Park City also had an abrupt closing this spring, but has since reopened its activities. On the phone with details about how they are operating amidst a pandemic, I have the general manager of Woodward Park City, Shadar Edelman. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you two also shut down operations, what, about March 15th?
Yeah, March 14th was our last day of operations before closing for 69 days.
Yeah. Had you been able to stay open, had it been just a year like we've known, I mean, would you have been able to continue to operate indoors and then just, what, wait for the snow to melt?
Yeah, that's our intention in a normal year, would be to operate our indoor and outdoor on snow for as long as practical on snow, and then go indoors until indoors only until mountain biking dries out and we're able to open that. So we're at that point now this spring. We just opened our mountain biking a few days ago now.
Oh, okay. So tell me, I mean, what you do have open. I've drove both indoor and outdoor facilities.
We do. We have our indoor and our outdoor. Our first phase, we reopened May 23rd. In our first phase, we stuck to wheeled sports only in our concrete and paved parks. And then last Sunday, we added our trampoline park, our spring floor, our gym floor area, as well as our downhill mountain biking, three brand new flow trails designed by Alpine Bike Parks. Lift access downhill mountain biking open daily from 10 till 8 now.
All right. So the trampolines, you have those indoors, yeah?
That is correct.
Yeah. So what about those foam pits?
Foam pits are in phase three. So our next phase will be in July when we open our summer camps for all of our different action sports. And our foam pits will be part of that phase reopening.
Oh, okay. So I can understand, dirt, we don't necessarily need to clean, but it seems to me things that people jump into with their mouth open, how are you going to make that safe?
So we're doing a disinfecting every 90 minutes. We clear the floor and get everyone out of those indoor spaces, and then we clean those areas with the entire team. We've got a combination of disinfecting foggers, backpack sprayers, hand cleaning on all the common contact surfaces. So a really tremendous effort from the team during those changeover times so that we are clean and ready to go for the next session every time.
Wow. All right. And so how is it working now? I mean, do people still buy 3-month passes, or is it a day-to-day thing, or?
It's a mix. So we have our membership program is still in action. So you can purchase a membership. It's a 3-month minimum commitment, and then it's an ongoing subscription from there. But we also have daily tickets available for either indoor or mountain biking or both. And then private lessons are available right now with camp programming and group lesson programming starting next month in July.
Yeah. Are you having to limit your numbers?
Yeah, we're definitely a little different model than what we had previously. We were an overlapping, ongoing 2-hour cycle before. Right now we're doing a 90-minute session indoors and then, like I said, clearing everything out, doing a full clean, full disinfect, and then starting again. So, and definitely managing those numbers to those spaces. Outdoor, we have a limited capacity on mountain biking as well to limit the potential crowding.
All right. And talk to me a little about your outdoor mountain biking. What have you got? You mentioned three flow trails. Anything else?
Yeah, 3 flow trails, downhill mountain biking, everything from a rollable but super playful green line for beginning downhill up to a pretty solid pro line jump level. So, multiple options, multiple ability levels on that downhill. And then we do have concrete and pavement pump tracks and outdoor skate parks as well for those wheeled sports, whether you're scooter or skate or BMX or mountain biking.
All right. So what are the hours?
We are 10 till 8 every day. So we'll be that lift access biking goes until into the evening after work options are available. But yeah, 10 till 8 every day is our model. We've reopened with that, and that's the intent is to continue with that 365 days a year.
Wow. Do people need to make reservations in advance?
We definitely request that. It's a strong request. So please, you can get a better price if you book online in advance, and that fits into our capacity. We will make exceptions if there's space available on a walk-up, but we prefer if you can purchase in online in advance.
All right. And then you've also got the Woodward Play It Forward Fund. Tell me about that.
So this is a Play It Forward Fund powder initiative with the Cumming family. But Woodward Play It Forward has started with a $200,000 donation from the Cumming family. And we've put $75,000 of that initially towards Park City Community Foundation's response fund. And this will be an ongoing charitable work for us of how we can most best engage with our community in a supportive way. And we've started with that $75,000 contribution towards the COVID response fund that the Community Foundation manages.
All right. And what are the plans then for the other 125?
We're working on those additional plans. Our Play Forever commitment is always to protect the environment and enable participation. So we'll be working with different partners in those missions. Right now, the first focus was COVID-specific response so that we can help support those most in need in the community, which the Community Foundation does such a great job of identifying those needs and being able to manage towards that. And we'll always be open to other suggestions or requests of where that grant money can go.
So people can make donations. Will you also be taking a portion of the profits and putting an end to this fund? I mean, is it something ongoing or is it just a one-time deal?
It is absolutely ongoing. So there's donations available. You can make donations when you purchase memberships or camps on our website. We're engaging with our employees, whether they're able to donate time or in-kind or potential contributions. And then we will have various days, we call them Play Forever Fridays, that will start up soon where a portion of the proceeds from tickets in that day will go towards this fund. So a kind of a mix of all of those things.
All right. And then again, you mentioned that the camps are starting in July. You're taking registration for those now?
Yes, we are. Camps start July 6th. We've got a combination of Monday through Friday camps, or you can do the same day of week for 5 weeks. And we've got 6 weeks of camps running from July 6th through August 14th in all of our different sports. So cheerleading, skateboarding, mountain biking. Multi-sport is one of our most popular right now, where you can kind of try all of the different sports that we have available. And at whatever ability level you might be at, you can come in and do a mix of the sports and find where your passion lies and hopefully continue on with that.
Okay. Hey, Shadar, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, it's really exciting to be reopened and in the community again as an operating business. We understand how much of a responsibility that is in this environment, and we're really excited about this response we've had from the community and stoked that we can provide a great place for our guests to come and play. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And have you started thinking about what the winter looks like?
Of course. We're always thinking about that, both in many, many different ways. It's, you know, there's the operational side of what we can do better and earlier to be first on snow and best on snow for our members and guests. And then there's, the uncertainty surrounding what the environment's going to look like this winter and how we're going to fit into that.
All right. Hey, I appreciate your time, Shadar.
Thank you, Leslie. Have a great day.
Shader Edelman, the general manager of Woodward Park City. KPCW News Time now, 8:57. Well, the Snyderville Basin Recreation District is updating its strategic action plan for the first time in 7 years. The district is presenting the plan and taking input at a virtual meeting today. Recreation District Director Brian Hanton told us that the Zoom meeting is set from 6 to 8 p.m. tonight. To find out how to access the session, you can go to the district's website and link to the events tab. He said the last time they formulated the action plan was back in 2013.
When we did this in 2013, there was 10 items that were listed as top things that we needed to or help implement into the community. We were able to knock off 7 of those with cardio weights, courts, basketball courts, lap lanes, group fitness, trails and trailheads, outdoor lap lanes, and off-leash dog areas. And these were all things that the community was looking for, and that's why we want to go through this process again, knowing how much our community has changed over the last 5 to 6 years.
Lisa Benson from the firm Landmark Design is a consultant for the district. She said there have been some changes, but some priorities in the old plan are still popular.
But what is interesting is that some of those facilities are still desired by residents and still came up as scoring high in this newer study. Things like the indoor multipurpose fields, also outdoor multipurpose fields are still important. But there are also some items that came up as more important, more recently, like climbing walls, outdoor pickleball courts. Some of those items kind of rose to the top. As Brian said, as they meet priorities, they can continue to see what new needs arise and focus on those newer needs.
We asked Hatton if the district will continue to develop more space for an ice rink.
I mean, it's still on our list of things, and we're working with the city. We're continuing. There's a private entity that's still in the works of developing a two-sheet rink by the Black Rock Development. And so we're hoping that continues to fruition, and it's only a mile away from the existing ice rink. So that's kind of our plan, is to hope that continues.
Again, the district is hosting a Zoom meeting today, 6 to 8 p.m., to take input on its strategic action plan. This is KPCW Park City. Stay tuned. Headline news and then Cool Science Radio. It's 9 o'clock.